Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello, my name is Todd Weir, and welcome to another edition of New Books in Intellectual History. In 1873, Rudolf Virchow, who was a well-known Prussian liberal and scientist, declared in Parliament that the liberals and the German state were waging a Kulturkampf, a culture war, against Catholicism, which they understood to be the chief hindrance to progress and modernity. In the past two decades or so, historians have rediscovered the Kulturkampf of the 1870s as a pivotal event in German history that contributed to a confessionally divided political landscape in Germany. The term has recently been liberated from its German origin and applied to Europe as a whole, so that we now speak of a transnational culture war between the forces, generally speaking, of liberalism and modern global Catholicism. Historians have appropriated ideas from literary studies about the ways in which the binary opposition of self and other helped to contribute to identities, and they have called in this context Catholicism the other of modernity. Modernity understood to be implicitly as secular and possibly Protestant. But what of the other religious others of European modernity, the Jews? How did Jews relate to, contribute to, perhaps oppose, or even manipulate anti-Catholicism? These are questions explored by Ari Yoskovich in his new book, The Modernity of Others, Jewish Anti-Catholicism in Germany and France, which recently came out with Stanford University Press in the Studies in Jewish History and Culture. This is a very ambitious work, which takes the reader from the late Enlightenment to the 20th century, and from France to Germany and back again. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Ari to this show.
Thank you.
And let me first of all compliment you on a wonderfully written book. I appreciate your style, especially if I'm correct, it's not your first language.
That's
English.
Correct. Right.
But anyway,
well, thanks.
Lovely English style. So let's just start off with a question that we usually ask, which is just tell us a little bit about yourself, something about the interests that led you to this project.
Mm-hmm. Well, this project actually grew out of an engagement with German history, European history, and Jewish history in grad school, and it started with the Virchow speech that you mentioned, which we read in grad school in a seminar. And in that speech, where Virchow coins the term Kulturkampf, he actually also speaks about the Jews. He explains that Catholics are a problem for the state, in the way they constitute a separate body. And then he singles out the Jews and says, well, the Jews actually show a different model. You don't need to be hierarchical. You don't need to have a pope to survive through the millennia and be successful. So my first question was, well, do we have that often? Is that a standard line? And I couldn't find a whole lot, actually, about that. And then I switched around the question, well, what did the Jews say about all that? Were they... This is an invitation. Did they accept the invitation? And out of this developed my first article on the subject, actually, which is on the Kulturkampf. So this is, for German historians, modern German historians, one of the key moments of political history, a conflict between liberals and Catholics, as you said, that deeply traumatizes Catholics, certainly. It's completely absent from Jewish history. So my question was, what do Jews say to the central moment of German political history? And I found that they do actually participate in some ways in that moment, and it is actually an opportunity for them, an opportunity just before the rise of anti-Semitism. So once I wrote this article, I circulated it, I spoke to colleagues, and one colleague asked me First of all, well, is this a German thing? And I didn't know, which motivated me to go to broaden my scope geographically. And then he asked me if this is indeed the first instance of this. And Catholicism didn't actually start in the 1870s, as we know. And as I was researching that, I became more and more interested in the similarities across borders. And I ended up writing about Germany and France, two very different countries. One, Germany, is split between Catholics and Protestants. And in the German Empire, as it congeals in the 1870s, it's one-third Catholics, two-thirds Protestants. France is really predominantly Catholic, and Protestants have a very different role there, and a much more symbolic role, perhaps. So I decided on two countries that are very different, but this could have been written about many other countries. There is an Atlantic phenomenon here, in fact, of anti-Catholicism. And then I also started to go backwards, and I discovered for myself that even though I wanted to write a book originally about the late 19th century, the most interesting stuff is really happening earlier. And I try to trace this phenomenon of Jews speaking about the Catholic Church back all the way to the point when Jews enter politics for the first time, enter modern politics for the first time. That is, they don't just, you know, diplomatically try to appeal to the king, you know, to avert an expulsion or something similar. They actually try to create alliances with new political movements. And that pretty much happens in the late Enlightenment and around the French Revolution, or just before the French Revolution in France. And that's then the book that developed out of that is a book that goes all the way from the very earliest statements in German and French on anything political to the point when I believe anti-Catholicism really starts to decline as a political, as a central political feature of their life. It doesn't disappear, of course, as a private opinion one might hold. Can continue until today, but that's the late 18th century to the early 20th century.
Excellent. Just to, before we actually go into the book, I have a few questions, sort of about you know, this way in which this book is situated, or where this book is situated in debates that are going on now amongst historians and scholars in various disciplines. And the first was something about the disciplines. This book is a work of German history, French history, Jewish history, among other histories we could identify. Can you say something about the ways in which these disciplines perhaps interact that might say something or indicate why this topic has not appealed to historians until recently? I mean, you mentioned maybe one or two other historians, but probably in English, this is the first major study of this phenomenon, Jewish anti-Catholicism. Why has that not been attractive to historians previously?
So there have been two very small studies before, and they both came out of Jewish history. So if you want to locate where interest has been before I wrote this book. And if my sense is, well, German historians actually found an interest in Jews, not just as well, victims of mass violence, only very rather late. So I'm already a generation I'm already an historian who grew up basically, you know, was socialized into an academic world where that is normal. But up to the 1980s, I would say, Jewish history was somewhere on the margins of German history. The question is really, why haven't Jewish historians, those people who have founded whole institutes just to study German Jewry, like the Leo Beck Institute, why haven't they studied this topic? And my sense is that there are two basic reasons. Well, one is that it might be seen as an embarrassment, at least when you put it in those terms. That is, when you use the word anti-Catholicism, which is seen as an exclusively negative term, this is very different than the term anti-clericalism, which is a term that is used much more in French history, where people also have spoken about Jews being anti-clerical sometimes. It's much more neutral. It can go either way. It depends on who's speaking, if it's a negative term. So once you use the term anti-Catholicism, I think there was little interest in describing Jews, a marginalized group, that, well, faced the genocide in Germany to then basically accuse them of something like anti-Catholicism, which, well, even with the structure of the word, sounds so much like anti-Semitism. Mm. And I think the people who were skeptical about that were also right. The parallel really doesn't work. Even though the term sounds similar and reconstructed in a similar way, it meant something very different. So embarrassment is one reason. The other reason is really that when they did touch on it, it was seen as the inverse of Catholic anti-Semitism. So it's basically a defensive move. The Catholics were basically accusing the Jews, so obviously as a reaction, they would, what wasn't even called critique necessarily. It was just they were defending themselves. So my intervention is to really see, to read Jewish anti-Catholicism like Catholic anti-Semitism has been read. That is, as something independent, something that certainly comes out of a complex environment. And what Catholics do, of course, will motivate Jews to do things, but there is an independent story there nevertheless. It's a story that has a lot to do with how Jews feel about themselves, not what Catholics did. And it's only once you take that step, I believe, that it becomes actually an interesting story, because now it is a story about how does a minority become modern? How do Jews, one marginalized group, really think about themselves as members of a modern society by speaking about another group that in certain contexts was marginalized? And as long as you see it simply as a defensive move, that's just not a question you would even ask.
So I wanted to ask another situating question about where this book lies in debates at present. And this has to do with also how this relates to intellectual history, because it's really, a bit more of a cultural history, perhaps, than a sort of classic intellectual history. But in some ways, you are engaging with sort of key aspects of intellectual history. And one of these is the entire critical energy that is currently going into thinking about secularism as an issue that is like a very much a, I guess, now understood as a macro historical phenomenon that describes key elements of how religion is situated in modernity. And this term secularism is used not to mean what I think many people would understand as secularism. In other words, it's not what in the U.S. is known as secular humanism, right? A philosophy that is latently anti-clerical and overtly humanistic and immanent. It's also not what is understood as secularization, right? So it's not about the disenchantment of the world, the falling away of religious understandings and church control and church power. It does touch on these things, and it's a kind of a complicated history. But nonetheless, secularism now in the critical discourse means something else, and you are connecting your study to that literature. And I would just like you to perhaps define for the listeners secularism as you understand it and why it's actually significant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually came to the term secularism late. So the project itself started with my fascination with this phenomenon of Jewish anti-Catholicism, one minority speaking about another in their attempts to become modern citizens. And I ended up in a research fellowship for a year that with people who all worked on secularism. And I really only then realized that there is a whole group of people who are deeply critical of secularism. And it's to this literature that I'm trying to speak to. And for many of these critical thinkers, and these come originally out of anthropology, religious studies, sometimes post-colonial studies, secularism, as you say, is not simply the thing that ends up there, this neutral ground that you get when religion disappears, or the secular isn't this thing that just that is just there. It's something that has a structure that we can analyze. So I took some of various of these newer definitions and appropriated them basically for my purposes. And my definition is rather broad. And it's broad because that works for me, and I can explain why that is. The way I speak about secularism, it's a set of expectations about religion. And it is about how circumscribed religion should be. And that means it includes people we would perhaps call secularists in everyday conversation, or many people would, atheists, people very purposefully attack religion because they think it has no role in society, basically. But it also includes people who we might call middle-class practitioners of religion, who decided, yes, there is a role of religion in their life, but this is a religion that will take place in a particular location, in a particular time only, and perhaps is gendered also, is a thing that their daughters can learn, but not their sons, for example. So I try to include a wide variety of people in my concept of secularism, first of all, because I want to show certain underlying assumptions that many people share in the debates I'm looking at, who, at least at a first glance, seem to be on different sides of that divide. Basically, you could be looking at people who are very clearly arguing for a separation of church and state, and then others who, you know, in parliament will stand up and will say, no, separation is a problem because we need to control the church. The state actually needs to control the church. And what I try to tease out is also where the shared assumptions are. So that is one intervention, certainly. More into the literature, not so much into the literature of secularism, but using the literature of secularism as an intervention into the way we've written German history and European history. And then also it has to do with the fact that I'm dealing with two contexts, two very different contexts, France and Germany. And Germany itself is, of course, not homogeneous. And again, is a very complex patchwork of sovereign states. So I wanted to find terms that I can use analytically that will both work and not work for both contexts equally. And both in the German and the French context, you certainly have historical terms that one could use. There's confessionslos in Germany. There is laïcité in France. All these terms themselves, of course, have a history, and you would have to decide which of the many layers you would be trying to use. So I decided I'll actually use an anachronistic term, a term that certainly in the Enlightenment nobody would have used, certainly not as a self-description, not even as an insult, and try to make that productive for my purposes.
If I could just jump in there. So this might also clarify this term for the readers a bit more. Mm-hmm. Anti-Catholicism. We talked about the Kulturkampf, mm-hmm. right, and anti-Catholicism, and it's not about disliking Catholics, principally. Sure. So what's the utility of anti-Catholicism for a secularist project?
Mm-hmm. So when I try to understand secularism, I try to look not so much at the things people say about themselves. And this is certainly what people have done also in Jewish history. They've done it in many other cases too, but especially since we're talking here about a minority that is under pressure, the way people have tried to understand what it means for Jews to become secular is to see all the projects they had to reform themselves. My sense is that secularism is a lot about the religion of other people and how they should reform their religion. Always a much, much easier proposition, of course. So anti-Catholicism, in the context I'm describing, just seems to be the central other that defines what a good religion is supposed to look like. And it does it surprisingly in a context where you have mostly Protestants, if we look at Berlin, for example, and it works similarly in Paris, in a context where basically the vast majority of the population is Catholic, or at least nominally Catholic. So anti-Catholicism and anti-clericalism, and I ended up putting only anti-Catholicism in the title because there are only so many antis you're allowed to have in a subtitle, but it is about anti-Catholicism and anti-clericalism ultimately. And both of these create are debates about the Catholic Church that define pretty much what a person is supposed to look like who is a modern citizen and does religion.
Related then to this literature on secularism, there's been a great interest in this literature on religious minorities, probably more interest in Jewish as a minority group than Catholics as a minority group. I'm thinking, for instance, of Dagmar Herzog's book on pre-revolutionary Baden in the 1840s and the fact that liberals in the 1840s began to support Jewish emancipation. And she connects that to the, you know, the liberal attempts to reform the relationship of church and state, which is, of course, part of secularism, as you've mm-hmm. kind of suggested. Why are minorities so important? And what do we learn by looking at this debates about liberalism and secularism from the perspective of the minority, which is something I think that is new with your study, because many people, as I've said, looked at Jews within the context of secularism, but rather as something that from the perspective of essentially non-Jewish liberals, right?
Right. And I would say that actually even looking at So the literature on secularism that has been interested in minorities seems to have been interested in, coming out of post-colonial studies, seems to have been interested mostly in Islam, I would say, and in colonial politics in India and such things. And I think there's a more recent, wider interest actually in Jews and secularism, but I think these works are just coming out, and I'll just plug another book. I'm actually editing a volume also on secularism and the Jews, which should come out next year with several essays on that topic. Why are minorities important for the study of secularism? And why can Jews be important, much like Muslims have been important in the literature? One central argument has been the accusation that secularism is a false universalism. That is, people say, well, you should become part of a secular world by abandoning a particular religion. And it seems that this secular world is indeed just is neutral. You finally don't have to be something. You just can be a citizen, a rational citizen. And it's precisely when you start to study those who don't seem to be easily included in that secularism that you notice that that is a false universalism. So a classic example of that, cited by a prominent scholar recently, Joan Scott, who wrote about the veil, is this notion that, well, why do certain religions need special holidays in Europe? And why do they need to ask to leave work? Well, the universal holidays that are secular holidays happen to be Christian holidays. So for a Christian, you don't actually have to mark yourself as religious. You don't have to do anything to not be at work for Christmas. You can be culturally Christian, and that's not an issue. That is much harder when you're a Muslim. Suddenly it becomes a religious issue. This can't be just a cultural issue. So there's this sense that it seems that there are universal rules, but somehow the universal rules just hide the fact that these are the rules of certain people. And other people have criticized the idea that, well, secularism has to do with class. Basically, there is a middle class notion here that's being promoted, and that, well, the agenda isn't open. It seems to be about just pure rationalism, but it's not. So I think Jews and Muslims have had a role in that and will continue to have a role in that. Because I wasn't just writing about one minority, but in fact about two groups who have been marginalized, and the word minority is, of course, tricky when we are talking about Catholics, especially mm-hmm. in certain areas and in a place like France. But if we're just speaking about discourses of state and politics, I think there are good reasons to speak about at least Catholicism, the Catholic Church, as at least a group that people aspire to exclude from those realms. So I'm actually talking about two marginalized groups. And from analyzing the relationship between one marginalized group to another marginalized group, my sense was that this accusation of false universalism doesn't actually get at the heart of the problem for a minority like Jews, at least. Jews themselves, in fact, were accused of false universalism. The accusation of the enemies of a particular type of secularism was that secularism and separation of church and state and various ideas that we associate with secularism are really Jewish ideas. They're really a Jewish invention. So the accusation itself that secularism isn't neutral has a history, and it ties into the history of anti-Semitism as well. But there's also the sense that, well, what was the problem for Jews as they entered the public sphere? How did false universalism really affect them? And my sense is that what people have emphasized is only due to a certain limit. And people have emphasized that Jews couldn't speak about themselves, basically, as Jews in the public. There's this idea of, you're a Jew at home, but publicly you're just a citizen. And from analyzing parliamentary speeches and parliamentary performances, really, of politicians, Jewish politicians, my sense is that that is not really true. In fact, it's expected of them. Jews can speak as Jews, especially when Jewish topics are at issue. They are the experts on the matter. Sometimes Parliament will wait for them to return. They're needed. Where false universalism does come in is when one minority wants to speak about another minority. Now, as I mentioned when you asked me about why anti-Catholicism, why anti-clericalism, anti-Catholicism is one of these central issues that defines secularism, but it just defines politics too. Parliaments, as soon as they start to really legislate actively, have to legislate on the churches. And in that case, on the churches, not as a religious issue, but because the churches are a political issue. They are as powerful entities in the state. The state assumes the prerogative of regulating them. That means the minute Jews enter these bodies, they also start to legislate on what some can see as a political problem, and certainly the people who propose legislation see as a political problem, and others still see as a religious issue. So the conflict really starts about what is a political issue, what is a religious issue. And my sense is that the problem for Jews was they were challenged as basically being an involved party. They cannot be neutral people. False universalism basically means one minority cannot speak about the central issue, which is another minority, because they will be seen as partisan, basically. They cannot speak as neutral people. If Jews legislate to limit the power of the Catholic Church, well, is that just a reaction to Catholic anti-Semitism? Or is that just an expression of a particular Jewish way of doing secularism? So it's my sense that that is why... So that would also be my intervention, basically, into these larger debates about minorities and secularism, and really two topics that we cannot think apart anymore in current debates about secularism.
Yeah, no, there are many thoughts come to mind when you're talking about this false universalism, and then also the you have that interesting section where I think you're looking at French parliamentary debates from the 1840s to, and then moving on to German debates 1860s 1870s, where you talk about the ways in which the Jewish parliamentarians, the moments in which it's quite understood that they are going to speak not as the universal citizen, but as the Jewish citizen. And then in other cases where they are challenged trying to be universal and being accused by their opponents of being particular. So I had some questions about method and so on, but maybe it would be good now to move a bit more into the substance of the book. You work chronologically. You have several chapters, one I think on late Enlightenment, one on the Romantic era. You look at the sort of period of 1848 revolution up until the 1870s, Kulturkampf, and then you end sort of on the question of late 19th century anti-Semitism and so on. So, I think what is interesting in your argument here is the ways in which you're looking at how Jewish anti-Catholicism changes and how that change also reflects evolution of secularism, because of course secularism is a constantly changing project, and there are, as you said at some point, multiple really secular projects that, in a sense can be seen to contradict one another. So if you wanted to, you know, I certainly want to talk about the issue of confession. I don't know if you'd like to say anything about the late Enlightenment sections. Mm-hmm. Or
sure. I mean, for me, the stages are not just stages of secularism, because everything changes. The Jews involved changed, politics involved changed, what politics means changes, their enemies change, and indeed this whole secularist environment changes, what it means to be a good citizen and what the foils are that now define a good citizen. But I can just briefly perhaps outline these stages that I try to show in the chronological chapters of the book. And at the beginning, indeed, is the late Enlightenment. So before that, it's not that before that Jews never speak about Catholicism. And my sense is what they can do is be disruptive in a sense. What they can adopt is they certainly see in their environment the conflict between Protestants and Catholics, and they certainly can read and enjoy and share the very often lewd anti-Catholic propaganda coming out very often in pictorial form. The new thing really in the late Enlightenment is that Jews can actually say something by doing that. They can say something about politics, how they imagine the ideal body politics, well, what they imagine it to look like. So I start with Moses Mendelssohn, one of the key figures really of the Jewish Enlightenment, the first prominent Jewish intellectual who writes a key text in the 1780s, Jerusalem. So I traced back the origins of Jewish anti-clericalism to that period. What I discovered is that in this period, Jewish anti-clericalism is highly successful, actually, contrary to what one might think. What does it mean to be successful? They can actually prove to be universal citizens by being anti-clerical. In the Enlightenment context, in the late Enlightenment context, there are several Jews who basically write for a German and French audience about the problems of the Catholic Church, including proposals how to reform the Catholic Church, so it's not so backwards. And from all we can tell, from all I can tell, their environment actually thinks that's a great thing. They're showing they're not the old Jew anymore. They've moved beyond their old ways. And even though they're writing about another group, they're actually exhibiting an enlightened worldview. The assumption we might have as sort of coming out of basically a traditional narrative of progress is that things get easier and easier for Jews. But the story I'm telling is actually the inverse. When Jews enter politics, it's very easy for them to be anti-Catholic, and it does what it's supposed to do. And then the story continues to be one of increasing challenges to that model. And the first challenge is the rise of Romanticism, the Napoleonic period, basically the post-French Revolution era. During the Enlightenment, Jewish anti-Catholicism can still sometimes be a loyalist act, especially when you have kings who are trying to assert their rule against the church, or when you have, as in the French Revolution, outright anti-church regimes. In that case, you can be both a good anti-clerical in relationship to your fellow Enlighteners and to the king. So that follows a very traditional model, actually, of how Jews do politics. In the Romantic era, that doesn't work anymore. So even starting with the Napoleonic regime, but then even more with the Restoration regimes after 1815, these regimes that come out of this turmoil try to create new alliances with the church. Being anti-Catholic, being anti-clerical, is now an oppositional position. And people who are closer to the Jewish community, who in that sense are more mainstream, who represent others, actually are now unwilling to go that way. That's just not a winning strategy. the people who will now be interested in anti-Catholicism are really oppositional figures. People like Heinrich Heine, basically, who are artists who the only thing they have to lose is their reputation of really saying edgy things. These types of people will now they'll be anti-Catholic, and they'll actually develop a new type of anti-Catholicism because of the type of investment they have. It will be highly polemical, and it is, as in Heine's, highly poetical as well. The next step really comes with the mid-century, and the key moment here is 1858, the Mortara affair, which, by the way, is also depicted on the image on the book. This is a famous case at the time in which a Jewish child is baptized by his nanny when he was very young because he was sick. The nanny eventually confesses to her priest. The priest, well, reports it up the chain. All of this happens in the Papal States, so the Pope is not just the spiritual leader there, but actually the political leader of this area. It's happening in Bologna. And the result is that the papal police come and take the child, come and take the boy, and take him to Rome, where he will be raised as, well, in the Catholic Church, and eventually he becomes a priest, and will stay a priest, in fact, for the rest of his life. This case deeply offended not just Jews, but many liberals, because it went against ideas about what a good family is supposed to look like, the integrity of the family, the integrity of the head of the family, the patriarchal family is being broken up here. So there was wide outrage about this. I wouldn't say that this case actually creates Jewish anti-Catholicism. Actually, in the immediate aftermath is not really, you don't really see so much of a rise of Jewish anti-Catholicism, mainly because they're still trying to plead with the Pope directly. But the result really of 1858 and several other moments that I won't go into is that Jews have the sense that that the people who are against the Jews are now the people who are also against the rest of the world and against the liberal order. So, well, I'll mention one more event. That's the Syllabus of Errors of 1864, where the papacy, Pius IX, published a list of mistakes of the modern era that he condemns: democracy, freedom of religion. So this was, again, one of those instances when Jews, in fact, when it was not about the Jews, but Jews could really now see this as a global fight. So it's in this period that actually anti-Catholicism becomes something, in a sense, easy again. It becomes something convenient again. This is the period when Jews will, in fact, be somewhat embraced by the liberal parties in Germany, for example, and they will follow their anti-Catholicism as well. And this leads us then to the Kulturkampf, the conflict in the 1870s that I mentioned earlier. And eventually, with the rise of anti-Semitism, this whole story comes to an end. So the rise of anti-Semitism, the Dreyfus Affair, there are still several moments when it does seem opportune, in fact, to be anti-Catholic. But eventually, the costs are too high. To be an outspoken Jew and say something against the Catholic Church will just undermine the organization you're trying to join that is challenging the Church. So it makes more and more sense for Jews to just not say something publicly. And that's pretty much how the book ends. Mm-hmm. Then.
Very good. Something going back to maybe the 1840s, you know, there's a question as to why Jews, you tend to speak of Jews as a sort of whole in a way, but there seems to be an identification with the aims of liberalism on a whole, in a general sense, that seems to be a general point of an agreement. And there seems to be an agreement on at least some aspects of secularism. In other words, it's in the interest of Jews as a whole to back a certain kind of secularism. And
And it's the secularism, I guess, that allows them, for instance, to be taking equal part in parliament and to self-identify as Jews when speaking about Jewish matters. You said that was a surprising finding, which I would agree with you. But it does make sense in terms of the way that people understood the proper organization of religion at that time, which was not complete... let's say sending it completely to the private sphere, right? There was a sense that that religious communities properly organized were a healthy part of modernity.
That's right,
right? And I guess the word that we would tend to connect it with in German history would be an idea about confession, mm-hmm. right? This German word Konfession, right? Denominations
right.
and so on. But there's really a I think we're kind of projecting this notion onto the word confession because. At the time, confession tended often to be understood negatively as right. exactly the wrong kind of being religious in public. But nonetheless, you are using the term somewhat positively, saying that there was a strategy among Jews, particularly in Germany, to present themselves as a confession, present their religion as worthy of the status of confession, like especially Protestantism.
Mm-hmm.
Could you say a bit more about that particular moment? How can we bring together secularism with an idea that we're going to have a society that's formed of confessions, right? Denominations.
Right.
It seems to be counterintuitive, but it's probably not. So.
Right. Because, even in one of those big traditional narratives, how do we get to the separation, ideas about the separation of church and state? How do we get to ideas about the neutral state? It's usually the wars of religion that are central. So it's, in fact, the big claim of the modern state that it can transcend these awful religious conflicts. And in that sense, it presupposes, in fact, a society that is divided. That's why you need the modern state to begin with. And it is interesting to think about, where... First of all, I think you rightly pointed out that I used the collective term Jews, and there were Jews, of course, who dissented from that position, and I'm also only talking about Jews as far as their public persona is concerned. This is a political position, so I would claim that this is the political position of most Jews who felt they should express themselves politically, but there were also others, and Orthodoxy is, in fact, in Germany, one of the exceptions. To that pattern, and Orthodoxy, much earlier than liberals, had alliances with the Catholic Church. Some things that liberal Jews would eventually turn to as well once in the Weimar Republic other options fail. This notion that we need religion to some degree in society for society to function. I think that is indeed central. And that's also why I use this type of term, why I define secularism the way I do. Because if I would go for secularism as atheism, which one might, I end up with so few people. And because my book really covers... 130 years approximately, I would end up with enough material for the late 19th century. There you can find enough atheists and many people you've written about as well. But the earlier I would move, the fewer people I would find. And basically, even in if I look at parliamentary debates in the 1860s, it's very hard to find a single secularist speaking out. So in that sense, I think you're right. There is even, and this is true even for France. I mean, we're more used to speaking in these terms in Germany. In France, there is a somewhat historical tendency, especially from political scientists, to project back the notion of laïcité. Basically, you have the French Revolution and the excesses of the French Revolution, as people say, the cult of the supreme being and so on. So you have great, very tangible examples of how radical the French Revolution tried to rethink religion. And then somehow people skip over most of the conflicts of the 19th century and you arrive at the separation of church and state in 1905.
and you seem to have a continuity in France of a concept of laïcité that really means there cannot be religion in the public sphere. Mm. And that is not really what 19th century French history looks like, for the most part. The Napoleonic, this new Napoleonic consensus that is created with, or attempted a consensus that is created with the Concordat, with the Catholic Church in the early 19th century, really tries to, pretty much like in Germany, find a particular role for the Catholic Church. And it was originally Napoleon's attempt to co-opt the Catholic opposition and to divide them, in fact. And liberals throughout the 19th century are not so sure if they want to end that type of arrangement. It's only very late that you get the majority for the separation of church and state. So I think it's true, and it's true for Germany and France, in fact, surprisingly, at least for people who are part only of the political science debates that I've read.
I want to stick, though, still to confession for a moment. Mm-hmm. So there's an argument made by liberals in the mid-19th century that there is a positive role for religion, mm-hmm. but that the Catholic Church is not fulfilling that role.
Yes.
And for Jews in particular, there is some utility to being anti-Catholic and to joining that critique in a way to also construct Judaism as a modern confession.
Right.
Can you go into that just a bit? Any examples? Or?
Well, so Jews do clearly confessionalize in Germany and in France. When in the various European contexts where Jews live, they basically articulate their own identity in terms that fit both the legal and political environment they're in. So the traditional division has been Eastern Europe, however defined, Jews tend to be identified more as a nation. They're part of multinational empires, and thus they're just one of the many nations living in these empires. In Western Europe, they are trying to be a religion. That is the mold, basically, that is available to them. And I think, as crude as that is, I mean, as far as these sort of crude divisions go, I think there's clearly something to it. What scholars have tried to show in the past decades or so is that Jews do actually adopt other forms of self-identification as well. In Germany, there's the term Stamm, which literally means tribe. So forms of, I mean, eventually the term ethnicity will be coined also in the 20th century, then in the mid-20th century, to express something of a more biological cohesion. So Jews do that in the 19th century already. They self-racialize sometimes. The term race in France is also used by Jews, with a liberal intention, in fact. Yeah. And so later, of course, you have the racialization of Jews from the side of anti-Semites. But there is also this notion of, well, the races come together and form the state. And Jews are just one of the many races, or in Germany they would say, einer der vielen Stämme, one of the many tribes, or, you know, the Bavarians and Swabians and Jews, and they came together and they create Germany now. So I think scholars have not undone this division. So in that sense, I think it's true. What they have done is, I think they've added some nuances to it. What they hadn't done, what they hadn't done is to argue that these types of representations, these ethnicized representations of Jewishness, that they could enter true high politics. And their confession was really the only game in town, it seems. The only thing you can say, well, either in parliament or, you know, in a speech you might give to enter parliament and in your campaign, is you might say, I'm, you know, from jüdischer Konfession, basically, I'm denominationally Jewish. What I found looking at parliament is that even that assumption isn't completely true. So ethnicized notions of Jewishness can even enter high politics. But I think you're right. I think confession is a central the central model that Jews have and Jews will adopt. And it will only fall apart once they feel the liberal promise is falling apart. And well, then we can think about history of Jewish nationalism, Jewish Zionism, and so on.
Well, moving perhaps in that direction a bit, I wanted to talk about the sort of the end of the Kulturkampf as a kind of high point of anti-Catholicism when Jews, you know, as you're suggesting, were able really to identify with liberalism in a quite overt way in many cases, and be leaders of even efforts to secularize the state. The case you bring up is Eduard Lasker, who was an important leader of the national liberals in Germany in the 1860s, 1870s, and in fact, I think was, you know, contributed to some of these pieces of secularizing legislation. So I wanted to move now, I think this is then going towards towards the end of the book, but the question of anti-Semitism, the rise of anti-Semitism, and how that changes the field of play, and how Jewish anti-Catholicism then becomes less attractive. And I was, you know, there's this response that Eduard Lasker gives to the rise of this anti-Semitism in Berlin, which is where he's based in the 1870s, 1880s. You know, there's the court preacher, Adolf Stucker, who is a sort of, you know, a conservative nationalist of a new vein. And then there's another sort of variation on the same theme, not from that background, but Heinrich von Treitschke, a former national liberal, who's, you know, turning to the right and embraces the idea of a Christian Germany. But Lasker, he's reflecting on Adolf Stucker and all of these anti-Semites around 1881 or 1880. And he's writing to Jewish colleagues, other liberals, and trying to raise money for liberal campaigns. And I think he more or less writes in one of these letters that that anti-Semitism is the confessional mask of conservatism, essentially, and that it's a way of trying to attack liberalism. And so his advice to his Jewish liberal colleagues is stay out the course, pursue the Kulturkampf, support liberalism. You know, he says it's actually good because this is going to separate the wheat from the chaff. You know, the real liberals are going to stick it out, and the lightweights are going to fly off. This is going to strengthen our party, anti-Semitism. So just stay the course. Now, do Jews just stay the course with liberal anti-Catholicism? I mean, okay, understood. Lasker's, I think, a very, you know, he's mislabeled by so many people as it being anti-Catholic. I don't think he's anti-Catholic, but he is anti-clerical to the degree that he believes that organized religion, organized Christian state religion, is impeding the growth of freedom. Okay, but anyway, there's a couple of questions in there. But what happens? Do Jews stick it out with the liberals or not?
I mean, they're never the most. So what it's a tricky thing I tried to do, because there is this old Catholic trope from that is 19th century Catholic publications that the Kulturkampf is really a Jewish invention, and that will be a central idea in early anti-Semitism, both in Germany, and it will even come up in France. Just as after the Franco-German War, there's a very strange relationship now, after 1870, 71, between Germany and France. But still, as far as Catholics are concerned, they look over and see the Kulturkampf, and what they see is Jews basically disempowering the church. So there is this big trope, and what Jews are never indeed, or there are very few Jewish figures, and certainly not as Jews, they don't really belong to the most radical fringe of the Kulturkampf. In that sense, what I'm trying to show is in no way is not precisely not what these Catholic polemicists were claiming. In this case, just trying to show that Jews are doing what other people are doing, but because they're other type of people, it actually means something else. In that sense, they're not actually doing so many unusual, surprising things for liberals in the 1870s. And there is an argument that, so there have been scholars, if there has been literature on this at all, it has been about this very short period. And there is another scholar, Olaf Plaschke, who emphasized rather that Jews were not willing to really fully embrace the Kulturkampf. And so we have a disagreement about that particular event and a Jewish investment. My sense is Jews are quite invested. The argument that really doesn't work for me is Jews are a minority, and thus they understand what another minority must go through. In fact, one fascinating thing I found is that, according to Bismarck's PR man, it was Bismarck who tried to argue this in one case when several Jewish deputies were not voting for a law he supported to prohibit the Jesuits in Germany, the Jesuitengesetz. It was Bismarck who actually wanted to suggest to some newspapers that, well, these Jews have personal reasons. They that's why they're not supporting it. He didn't mean it as a compliment. Today, of course, we mean it as a compliment. They're not the, you know, German liberalism failed. Only the Jews saw it. They saw it first. So my sense is that that argument doesn't work for me. They did indeed in this one case, this one anti-Jesuit law. In this case, they either voted against it or abstained. But those same people had a very mixed voting pattern, including one of the other leading Jewish liberals, Ludwig Bamberger, who actually decided to abstain from rescinding the law later. So I think it's just a much more complicated story. For Jews, once they when they looked at the Kulturkampf, the way I try to read it in as part of this very long story of Jewish anti-Catholicism is, how much sense does anti-Catholicism make as a framework of explanation? And anti-Catholicism, like this whole notion of a clash of civilizations, and this is not a 21st century term, which is basically the equivalent of Kulturkampf, so how much sense does this make to explain the world? You know, a good versus evil, backwards, progressive, enlightened and unenlightened, rational, irrational. How well does this work to explain what you're experiencing? And in certain cases, it seems to explain a lot, and in others, it explains less. So during the Dreyfus Affair, for French Jews, it suddenly seems to make a lot of sense suddenly again. This was interpreted mainly as a conservative Catholics attacking a French Jewish officer and then French Jewry. It was leftist Republicans who were defending the Jews. Everything seemed fairly simple. When anti-Semitism really emerged as a force in Germany, as a phenomenon of mass politics, things were much too messy for that type of interpretation. And that doesn't mean that Jews wouldn't first choose it nevertheless, because it was a convenient explanation, one that they knew, one that they had trained to use, basically. So in the very beginning of sort of anti-Semitic agitation in the late 70s, you do find Jewish articles in Jewish newspapers that say, well, you know, the ultramontanes, these sort of pro-papal Catholics, conservative Catholics, are basically just, this is a new ruse. They came up with a new trick to attack liberalism. As you say, anti-Semitism is just an attack on liberalism. So that was one interpretation, but that fell apart rather quickly. I mean, for some people, it took a bit longer than for others. But eventually, by the turn of the century, by the time German Jews read about what is happening in France with the Dreyfus Affair, this doesn't make sense as a global explanation anymore. The way it did make sense in the 1860s, for example, where they were reporting about things that had nothing to do with Jews in Jewish newspapers suddenly, the Chilean parliament and the conflicts there between liberals and Catholics, and just global news about the big conflict we're in, we know which side we're on, this makes perfect sense, these are our main enemies in Germany, they're the main enemy of liberalism everywhere. In that sense, and anti-Catholicism as this type of singular explanation, this Manichaean explanation of the world really breaks down. And I mean, it's this notion of a clash of civilizations that also drew me to the topic, I should add. It's the parallels between the way people envisioned the conflicts of the 19th century and are visioning today's conflicts with between the West and Islam, the way this is depicted. So similarly, an attempt to reduce complexity to one very simple, reliable binary. And once again, Jews are in an odd position of being both co-opted sometimes as a party in this conflict, but they can also be rather skeptical about why they're being co-opted, what that means, what that implies about their own role. So these parallels, I don't think one should overstate them. I think they're very useful for asking new questions, basically, of events that seem otherwise very, very familiar to historians of the 19th century.
Very good. I had only one trick question, which I saved for the end. I was thinking about, your... you do mention several converted Jews as mm-hmm. protagonists. And I was thinking of three that you mentioned, and only one of them you actually go into detail about. Mm-hmm. Julius Friedrich Stahl, who was the famous, essentially provided the most theologically sophisticated and polemically well-articulated argument against Jewish emancipation in the 1840s, was himself a convert from Judaism, with Karl Marx at mm-hmm. the same time, and Heinrich Heine. So they're all three, important mm-hmm. German Jewish mm-hmm. converts to Protestantism. This is getting back again to the question mm-hmm. of who are the Jews, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, why is only Heine worthy of treatment in this context?
Right. Well, Heine is an interesting figure because, the way I treat him is not just as a Jew, but somebody who uses his Jewish past in a very particular way to polemicize. And this is actually where the transnational history really is useful for me, where the comparative element comes in, because I try to show how he's read differently. Once in Germany as a Jew, this is a place where people know he converted to to Protestantism. They know why he converted. And basically, most readers, as far as we can tell from reviewers, either they ignore that he claims to be a Protestant or they don't believe it. In France, that's different. There are few people who understand this and many others who don't. And it's interesting to see what happens with these types of polemics and how they're read and if they work at all or not. And my argument was his anti-Catholicism is really awkward in France and really works very well politically and poetically, aesthetically in Germany. So here, it's not so much about me claiming that Heine is... we have to read Heine as a Jew because he was a Jew. But rather, he uses it productively. This is a resource for him. And because he uses his Jewish background actively to write a particular type of poetry, it tells us a lot about what it means to be a Jew in a certain place. That might be true for other people too, and I just haven't figured out how to write that type of history. And I think I do actually mention Börne too, who actually is a fascinating figure who does the inverse thing. He's a contemporary of Heine, actually has huge conflicts with him. He's one of those few Jews who actually is very interested in Catholicism as an alternative, as a political alternative. And he translates one of the big French revolutionary Catholics, Lamennais, who also is removed from the priesthood and the church, so he's an unorthodox Catholic, certainly by the time Börne actually really is interested in him. But he translates Lamennais' works and believes that Catholicism can contribute something to a utopian socialist project. And Börne hoped that he could distribute his works among the German artisans of Paris. So there are actually a few, I guess there are a few more of these converts in there, but it's particularly for Heine that I thought he actually gives me access to something I don't usually get, that because he's so hard to pin down that he's so interesting, not because it's so easy to just call him a Jew. It's precisely because we can't do that in any simple way that we learn so much by reading him.
Yeah, I guess the point is really about community in the end, and who is thinking, either they may be distanced from the Jewish community, but at least are thinking in terms of a community identity and so on. Because, of course, with Stahl, he's anti-Catholic as well. He's a good Lutheran,
right.
He's anti-Catholic.
Right.
But his anti-Catholicism is probably to be understood in the history of Protestantism more than as a reflection on his Jewish past.
Might just be a book waiting to be written. I don't know.
The other class of Jewish anti-Catholic thinker might be, and this is where I was just wondering how you deal with this, would be socialists.
Right.
Do we have anti-clerical Jews after this period? You're suggesting in Germany after the 1880s, anti-Catholicism loses its appeal.
Mm-hmm.
In France with the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
But I know from looking at researching free thought that there are many leading free thinkers who are of Jewish background. I think they actually very clearly are thinking through problems of being Jewish in Germany in the ones I've looked at. But I was just curious about, again, I was going back to this question about the connection between liberalism in particular and your subject and your Jewish community. What about socialist anti-Catholic Jews?
Yeah, it's something I haven't dealt with much because I think it merits a different type of approach. I think one can certainly write about them collectively. I'm just not. I think one needs to think about how one does that actually, and I don't know if I have. And what I ultimately wrote is the history of this type of question in the liberal era. And that's also why the chronology, the temporal limits of my work make sense, not just because I claim it was invented and declined, but also because somehow this is the era of liberal politics to some degree. And actually, towards the end, you get to a type of mass politics that already is much more complicated. And that's actually where Jewish anti-Catholicism seems to become, as a collective phenomenon, in a sense, as a phenomenon that one cohesively describe in terms of a Jewish identity, it becomes more problematic there. I think the alliances in this era of mass politics become more complicated. I guess the Kulturkampf is always this sort of linchpin somewhere, comes out of the old liberal politics, that is a politics where there are a few parties, or not parties the way we know them, really. And then the beginning of the type of mass movements that you need in politics to really get out the votes, that are in part inspired by the Kulturkampf, especially on the Catholic side. And they, in turn, their success in turn propels others to follow their example. So what I did write was, in a sense, the era of liberal politics. And when I do deal with Jews who could be part of the socialist tradition, certainly Berne can be read of, that pantheon, then it is because they are still liberals. Because socialism there is still emerging as independent entity. And I think it's a different type of story one would have to write about socialists who really are part of them, of mass movement socialism, basically, not just socialist thinkers. I think those do fit in, I think. But when we get to those, I think it actually needs a different book.
Well, it is a sort of conversion, isn't it? I mean, to become a socialist often is a type of conversion away from other communities of identity. So it makes sense that they would perhaps, where the Jewish community as a whole might not find it any utility in being anti-Catholic. It could be that if you're a have converted, so to speak, to socialism, that the religious question just takes on a completely different meaning and requires a different response.
So originally when I did my research for this, I would cast the net widely, and I found so much stuff, basically, that I became very selective, because it turns out anti-Catholicism, and if you want to write an intellectual history of it, you can start anywhere, basically, in any text, so many texts of the 19th century. But one thing I did look at was a Jewish lawyer in France, Kuno Bambalin. And he was one of the people who drafted the law for the separation of church and state, and he left a very rich archive and also some biographical narratives. And I thought his biographical narrative really was typical of left Republicans or socialists. He speaks about how he's born as a Jew, and then you have this. Well, you need a narrative break that includes sort of. The anti-Catholicism is also the break with his Judaism. It's when you realize that all religion is bad, and you move on, and that's a different type of politics, I think. So I think in that sense, anti-Catholicism still is a key feature, or anti-clericalism. It still has to do with their Jewish origin, but it fulfills a very different function. It's about abandoning both their Jewish background and the Catholic background of their state, mm-hmm. basically, or their society. So it's this dual break, which, I mean, you find some elements of that, I think, even among some liberal writers, certainly. I mean, just, you know, traditional Bildungsroman style of going through your revelations. But I think that is there. That's how one would have to read these socialists, probably. So
very good. Well, I don't know if the listeners heard this, but there were just bells ringing for about 10 minutes. We're sitting together in a very Catholic city of Munich. Just to bring us back to the topic, so Catholicism has survived.
Yes,
and they're still ringing the bells. But that's also maybe a sign that we're coming to the end of our interview. But I wanted to ask you one last question, which is it's the traditional question at the end of an interview, which is just tell us a little bit about your current research and sort of what the future holds in the near term.
So I've moved to a new century and a very different topic, a topic that, however, is again about Jews in another group. In a very different setting and with different questions, in fact. So I'm working on Jews and Roma, sometimes called Gypsies in the past, and their relationship. I'm curious about their relationship during the Holocaust, and I'm interested in their archival entanglement, as I would call it. So the working assumption that I have is that So that what we're dealing with is a unique case when we're talking about Jews and Roma, even though they had very little to do with each other in many places in Europe, even though in the Nazi era, they didn't suffer with each other, but usually next to each other, very often separated by a barbed wire fence. After 1945, the archives that are dedicated to the Holocaust, which come rather late, but also the earliest collection of Holocaust testimony, basically... Well, they're only about the Jews, but what we do know about Roma ends up in Jewish archives. Very often does. Especially in the West, what will become the Cold War West. So I'm very interested in this peculiar situation where two groups are oddly unrelated in a way that Jews and Catholics live next to each other. So if we come back to my first book... Jews and Roma in many places do live next to each other, but they really live in different spaces. The way the shops they enter, how they move through the city, how they use print media for communication, all these tend to be rather different. And then you nevertheless end up with an archive where you have a single type of system where their testimonies are next to each other, or where their history is next to each other. And I'm trying to understand what that does really. And it's of course, a case of competition of memory to some degree. This is what some people have emphasized. It's a case of memories inspiring each other. In all these respects, it's not unique to other types of competition. Where it is unique is precisely in this archival question. When we do speak about, there's a debate in France, that Holocaust memories pushing out memory of the colonies, for example. In all these types of debates, and these are deeply polemical and difficult debates, it's not so much about the archive. It's not that one group owns the archive of the other group. and so it's this very special situation that I'm trying to understand and trace, really, not just as an archival history, but as a history of a relationship that starts in the Holocaust or is intensified in the Holocaust and then continues into the post-war periods, of also breaking this strange barrier of scholarship sometimes that, you know, is either Holocaust scholarship or post-war scholarship, and trying to bring these together as one relational history. And this is a Western European project. So it's a European project when it comes to the Holocaust era, basically Hitler's Europe and the Europe of his allies. And then it is the Cold War West and the type of archives and histories that really will, after the Cold War, also dominate our scholarship.
Excellent. Well, I'm sure there's a lot of interesting comparative work you'll do, given the attitudes, particularly towards Roma in different countries, completely different sort of histories there. So it will probably be a fascinating study, probably bring you to many things you hadn't expected. I'm thinking, you know, comparing Spain, Italy, you know, the attitude towards the Roma is very different from what I know, compared to even, you know, England, Germany, and so on. Mm-hmm. So anyway, sounds fascinating. Well, Ari, thank you so much for being with us today, and appreciate you for making that long journey to Munich.
No. Well, thank you for having me.
Oh, you're welcome.
Wonderful.
Okay. Well, best of luck.
Thank you.